The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Canada has one of the most extreme housing crises in the entire world at the moment. A large part, although the government do not like to acknowledge this, right or left, seemingly, we bring in about 500,000 migrants a year. And that's just like, you know, we're giving them residency and everything. That's not including student visas, illegal immigration.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Today, I am in Victoria, British Columbia. I am in Canada for the first time in a very long time. And since I'm here in Canada, I have a very special guest. She is a filmmaker. She is a former activist. She's a social and political commentator. And this is Lauren Southern. Let's start out with an introduction. I know who you are, but for people who are listening who aren't familiar, tell them a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I've been doing the YouTube political commentary and filmmaking sphere for about 10 years now, since I was like 19 years old. Pretty crazy. My most popular documentaries are probably Farmlands on the persecution of the Boer people in South Africa who are being murdered on their farms, and Borderless about the mass migration crisis to Europe. And now today I do political commentary for Tenet Media.
We all know that in today's fast-paced world, it's harder than ever to live a healthy lifestyle. Just about everyone is struggling with gut issues, stress, inflammation, fatigue, or immune issues. Most of it comes down to diet, but getting nutrient-rich food consistently isn't always easy or affordable. With hectic schedules, processed foods, and the rising cost of healthy options, we all need a cheat code as the game of life gets more difficult. My cheat code is Optimal Human. With over 90 ingredients, including powerful vitamins and other nutrients, one serving of Optimal Human helps me fulfill my daily nutritional needs. And in my opinion, it tastes better than many of the other green supplements on the market. Optimal Human contains powerful superfoods like organic reishi mushroom for your brain, turmeric root for your joints, beetroot for cardiovascular health, CoQ10 for cellular health, and probiotics for gut health. It's simple to integrate into your daily life. Just add one scoop to water, a smoothie, or your protein shake and get an instant, delicious nutrient boost. Try Optimal Human today and get 50% off your first month by going to optimalhuman.com/Zuby. That's optimalhuman.com/Zuby, and you'll get 50% off your first month. Go check it out.
How do you get into this world?
I grew up in Canada. I did a recent video talking about growing up in Surrey, BC, which is a very high immigration area. So the combination of being in an extremely, you know, contentious immigrant area, as well as in Canada that was becoming increasingly social justice oriented, growing up in school, being told you're privileged because you're white, you're oppressed because you're a woman, these kind of things, it didn't quite jive with the reality that I was living. You know, Vancouver, most of the wealthy people you'd know would be Chinese here. So being told in social justice 12 in high school that, oh, you're actually oppressed because you're Chinese and privileged because you're white, that didn't match on to the reality that I was experiencing on the ground. So I, you know, a lot of people laugh about the fact that so many political commentators come from Canada, whether it be Jordan Peterson, Lauren Chen, Stephen Crowder, McInnes, all these people, right? Molyneux, myself. I think it makes a lot of sense. Canada kind of experienced the progression of extremist left politics a lot quicker than America, and at a degree that really pressurized millennials' experience in that world. And so when we talk about the wokeness, we're talking about something we lived, not something we're warning about.
Okay, that's interesting. I know a ton of Canadian people, and I grew up, when I grew up in Saudi Arabia, there were a lot of Canadians who lived there. But strangely enough, I feel like I don't know that much about Canadian culture. Like, I know I'm from the UK, so I have a very keen perception of the nuances and differences between, say, the UK and the USA. But when it comes to the UK and Canada or Canada and the US, I just don't have as good a grasp of how different and how similar those cultures and places really are.
Well, you're about on par with the understanding of our culture as our government then. If you ask Trudeau, he'd say we're a post-national state. We don't have an identity anymore, and they're doing everything they can to erase it. But there was at one point, I would say, Canadian culture and identity were a frontier culture. Like, these are the people that, you know, paved this land, like, so wild, and came out and, you know, created the fur trade and built forts. And these were adventurers up in the cold north, right? When you see those memes of Canadians with, like, the lumberjack outfit and everything, that was real. A hockey stick. Even when I was growing up, I had friends that would go out and play hockey out on the ponds, on the ice, right? And there's a real hardiness and beauty and kindness to Canadian culture. People mock it, that kindness, but I actually think it's a beautiful thing. When Canadians say sorry all the time, they actually do have a deep care for other people. I just think that's been lost, and there has been a... I'm trying to find the word for it, but everything has become a little more empty because I don't think we have the communities that we used to. When we engage in Canadian culture, whether it be, you know, the hockey or the kindness, it's all very performative, because when you're knocking on your neighbor's door, they don't even speak the same language as you anymore here. When we're talking about working on projects to improve the country, I mean, half our tax dollars are going overseas or back into government pockets. That sense of what was a Canadian community and culture has very much been lost. And a lot of the things that were previously seen as, you know, staples of Canadian culture have had to be, they've had to take away the bigotry from it, you know, even our national anthem, like everything that was Canadian has had to be wokeified to some degree.
You said something interesting. You said it had to be changed or something like that. And when you say had to, I'm like, well, why? Someone makes that decision. Was this, I doubt it was some democratic referendum where all the Canadian people decided that the word he is offensive and they need to change it. So
this is where I will defend the Canadian people, because I know everyone says, well, you guys voted for Trudeau. Like, yep, it must be bonkers. Well, no, when I was growing up, it was kind of traditional that Canadians didn't care that much about politics. We didn't fight about it all the time. You know, the one consistent joke was just that, oh, Americans are stupid or whatever. That was the one thing in Canada that was, like, kind of political that we talked about. People didn't like George Bush. But generally, when I was younger, people weren't so contentious about right, left, this, that. So when Trudeau was voted in, I remember being in my university bar, and I was like one of my only friends that voted conservative, and thinking, oh my gosh, this is the end of this country. But my friends weren't thinking, yeah, let's bring in mass immigration and, you know, she, her pronouns in the anthem and this kind of stuff. That was not what they were thinking. They were thinking, I can't wait for weed to be legalized. Because people like pot in Canada, okay, they're part of the culture.
I think there's a lot of stuff that in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, you know, those Bible-thumping conservatives were like, if you do this, it's going to lead to that and that and that. All the slippery slope. And people are like, ah, it's not going to happen. That doesn't make sense. And it's all happening right now across all these different countries. And it's like, yeah, they were right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's we can get into that.
Okay.
It's a really interesting analysis I have of the pot legalization stuff. And then they were just thinking, like, yeah, he's cool, he's liberal. It wasn't like this massive agenda to change anything. It was really the government that took it on its own shoulders to completely deconstruct our country. Yeah. And now I reckon if I ask half the people that voted for Trudeau when I was younger that were my friends, what do you think? They'd be like, this isn't what I voted for. I didn't vote to have no housing in my country. I didn't vote to have a complete and utter collapse of our infrastructure and our food prices shoot through the roof. I didn't vote to lose the neighborhood that I grew up in.
When you say no housing, what are you referring to?
Canada has one of the most extreme housing crises in the entire world at the moment. A large part, although the government do not like to acknowledge this, right or left, seemingly, we bring in about 500,000 migrants a year. And that's just like, you know, we're giving them residency and everything. That's not including student visas, illegal immigration, all these other work permits. We're talking the millions of people.
Yeah. Am I right in saying that's more than 1% of the population per year?
It used to be a country of 30 million, but we're like just adding to that. Yeah. We are the highest, one of the highest rates of immigration per capita in the world, okay, in Canada. So like more than America,
yep,
per capita. And we already don't have enough housing. our rent prices have changed from Vancouver, a place that would have been $1,500 even 6-7 years ago, is now $2,500 to $3,000, doubled, tripled in prices. And there's just no availability either. We do not have housing for the people living here right now. And every housing minister, every politician, Trudeau, is even out here saying, I'm going to build more houses, I swear, because it's the number one issue in this country right now is the fact that Gen Z and millennials will not be able to own a home. They won't. They're screwed. And they just will not attribute this to immigration. They refuse to talk about it. So they're continuing to. And part of it, I think, is intentional because a lot of our politicians have investments in property. And if the housing bubble collapses, particularly under the government, the Liberal government right now, it will destroy the country. And they don't want to have that on their name, that we destroyed the economy and they've propped it up for far too long. But also there's an entire corporate and, you know, landlord class that make a lot of money off of property being scarce and being able to pump up those prices. So this is kind of a very protected Ponzi scheme going on at the moment to make it so that everyone in this country is going to be forever renters and spending 50 to 75% of their paychecks.
How much of that do you think is malice versus stupidity and incompetence?
I think it is selfishness. Okay. I think it's selfishness on, you have corporations, for example, everyone in this country knows, I made a joke the other day that got me quite a bit of trouble where I just tweeted a photo of me with a little Tim Hortons cup saying, I love Indian food. And people got very upset. But that's because almost every single Tim Hortons, which once again, this is a Canadian staple.
Yeah.
Tim Hortons, I don't know half the people working there even know who Tim Hortons is, but he was a hockey player. And this is where you go to get Timbits as a kid. And it was all very Canadian. Mm-hmm. Almost everyone who works there now is Indian.
Okay.
And that is because when the economy started super struggling the last, you know, decade, particularly post-COVID, we Canadians couldn't afford to work for Tim Hortons wages unless you were like a high schooler, right? And even then, like a lot of people were just looking for better jobs. So Tim Hortons, instead of adjusting their wages and making them to be a living wage in this country or improving the work conditions, figured, well, we've got this great government program where we can just bring over cheap immigrant labor. And these people will complain. They're terrified of being deported. They're willing to work 3 to 4 jobs at a time and live in flats that are 15 people to a flat. I would recommend everyone watching follow Our Canada Housing 2. It's called Number 2 for a reason because it's the truth about Canada housing. And they will show all these photos of landlords that literally have like 10 Indians working at Tim Hortons living in their basement in tents in like a cockroach infested basement in first world Canada.
I don't know.
And these people won't complain. They'll will work ridiculous shifts. They'll work for wages that are subpar because there's, you know, slavery back home. So they're willing to do it. And now the native workers in Canada have no bargaining power. Mm-hmm. Like, you're going to go to Tim Hortons and be like, I'll only work for you if you pay me a higher wage and give me, you know, full-time hours.
Just to be clear on something, are these people who were already in Canada or are these people being specifically brought over to work these jobs?
These are people being mass imported to work these jobs. And unlike Dubai, they aren't being deported after they've done the work so that there's housing left. All these people need housing,
yeah,
and it doesn't exist already. So they're being imported on various different visas. I just did a story on this where I went to my hometown, Surrey, and I'm not kidding. You look at Surrey and you go immigration center. So these kind of middlemen that will help you immigrate to Canada. And there's one every 2 minutes. There's more immigration centers than McDonald's and Starbucks in Surrey.
Yeah.
You just walk down 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 2 minutes and go to one of these centers where you pay $50,000 and they'll bring your whole family over on some BS visa. They'll find a way, whether it's a student visa, work visa, family visa, fake marriage, this kind of stuff. They find a way to get you in. Right now, it's a massive scandal on Prince Edward Island, which is a very small province, where they found a loophole in the system where they felt if they went in as students, they could get permanent residency. And they've got recruiters in Punjab that are selling them, you know, $10,000 university degree education visas in places like PEI, but they're fake universities. So they're in strip malls and they've set up these universities where you go and you get a fake degree just to get into the country. And all the government has uncovered all of these students that don't have real degrees and have just done this as a scam.
Yeah.
And now they're doing hunger strikes saying, you have to give us permanent residency. I mean, we paid 10 grand to these recruiters in Punjab to get us over here. We did the process. Mm-hmm. You owe us residency now. And the government are saying, we got to shut this down. It's becoming a massive scandal. And it's going to be one of the biggest issues in this upcoming election, the immigration and the housing stuff.
Okay, that's interesting. I think when it comes to immigration, I mean, every Western country has got some type of immigration issue that's going on. And there's some similarities and there's differences. So it sounds like in Canada, the main issue isn't illegal immigration primarily, like it is at the southern border in the US or even in some European countries. It's that it's legal immigration. It's just kind of unchecked.
There was this place called Roxham Road in Ontario where it's literally like I went there. It's like a residential neighborhood, and there's just a little dirt path where you could walk into Canada and get to the other side. And tons of patients were just walking over into Canada and staying in a stadium in maybe it was Quebec. Anyways, they were all walking through this Roxham Road area. And I remember driving there being like, wow, this must be crazy, like this little secret path through a residential neighborhood. And I arrived, and the police were waiting on the other side of Roxham Road carrying luggage, putting them in the back of the cars and driving people into Canada.
Interesting.
I was so confused because I was in like Reynosa, Mexico, where the cartel are sneaking people over the border. And he had like Invisalign on and was like a really sharp dude. What are you doing in this migrant camp? And he's like, oh, I'm going to go spend a few months with my friend in Canada. And I'm like, so why are you in Reynosa, Mexico? And he's like, well, I looked into the legitimate ways to get to Canada and visa, and this was just quicker.
Yeah.
It was to go and illegally sneak into America and drive up to Canada illegally than to get the legitimate visa.
Show me the incentives, I'll show you the result.
Yeah.
Do you think some of it is because, I mean, if I think of Canada, two things that strike me about it is it's geographically massive and it's got a very small population. So I wonder if that sense of just this vast amount of space with this small, very small population, this very welcoming attitude, like this combination of things, where I think there's an attitude, an idea, I'm kind of guessing here, that, okay, we need more people. There needs to be, I think there are people who will just think, okay, well, we're underpopulated in a sense, and so let's just kind of be very tolerant and welcoming of all forms of immigration as long as it is bringing human beings into the country.
I think this is the very interesting part of the immigration debate, is how incapable the average person is of doing like secondary thinking.
Oh, no. People don't connect dots at all.
Okay, well, we need more workers here, Lauren. We need to increase the population. Great. Do we have the housing for that? That's just like question one, right? Mm-hmm. And the answer is no. So they say, oh, well, let's just bring in lots of workers and they'll build more houses. Okay, well, those people have to live somewhere as well. So, but even aside from that, do we have the infrastructure? We don't have the doctors. I know that much. Mm-hmm. We don't. Our hospital wait times are through the roof right now. Do we even have the infrastructure when it comes to how our cities are built, when it comes to the roads, for example? I was going to the airport the other day, and there was one stretch of road that is getting very bad in Vancouver. People will know it's near Park Royal, North Vancouver area. And I was on this road, didn't pass by one set of lights for over an hour, just standstill traffic. It's getting more and more like the same. The city is unlivable in places like Vancouver and Toronto. You cannot move. There are so many people. And it's not like the immigrants are going up to the Northwest Territories, where, sure, they actually incentivize people by paying them to go live there. Because they need more population, but they're not going there. They want to move to places like Surrey, places like Richmond that are massive immigration hubs because they don't really have an interest in becoming a part of Canada, at least not the recent immigrants. Immigrants that came in the 90s, early 2000s, pre-90s, loved Canada and wanted to integrate, right? But the recent immigrants want to become a part of... Canada calls it... We don't call ourselves a mixing pot. We call ourselves a cultural mosaic. And so, you know, a mosaic, it's got all these different colors, but none of them are really connected. And they want to join the Indian mosaic in Surrey. They want to join the Korean or Chinese mosaic in Richmond, in these kind of neighborhoods, or the increasingly small, you know, European mosaic, if they're like the 1% of European migration still coming here. And I think what Canada needs to look at is not only all of the infrastructure stuff that isn't adding up, but what happens when that mosaic starts to become all one color? Uh-huh. what happens when the vast majority of our immigration is just from China to certain areas, and it's no longer a beautiful picture at all. It's just, I don't think we're really even considering these cultural factors. Mm. I have friends of mine that are quite liberal that are working in the education system, and they're coming to me like, I'm flabbergasted. Why are so many of these students cheating nowadays? This is never something I experienced before, but we have such incredible levels of cheating in the universities today because of these Indian visas and people coming over on fake degrees and whatnot, that even my very liberal friends are coming to me like, okay, there's something culturally wrong here.
Yeah.
There's something culturally not.
They'll just whisper that to you though, right? Like, I'm sure they wouldn't say that out loud.
Or do they? Lately they have it.
Okay.
Lately they have, it wasn't like that before, but I have friends of all different backgrounds, education, politics, that are now finding it impossible to ignore.
Yeah.
You talk to the average Canadian, and I mean, unless they're working a job in government, if it's not like directly for government, they're a contractor to the government through a private corporation. That's the way that the government hides a lot of the fact that they control so much of our infrastructure. But yeah, no, a lot of people are being more honest because they simply can't afford not to be.
Yeah.
They don't have anywhere to live anymore. It's in their best interest to speak up.
I actually wanted to get into that because it's interesting because I'm from the UK. You know, immigration has been a big conversation there. It's not as much now as it was, say, from 2016 to 2020. I'd say that was kind of like the peak of the conversation. I mean, I know you were spending a lot of time in Europe at that time. There was the whole migration crisis happening in Europe. In the US, it's a massive conversation right now with everything going on with the porous southern border. And it's an issue that a lot of people do not speak up on, honestly, because they don't want to be called mean names. I know that you're very accustomed to being called mean names. Just before this interview, I was like, let me just do a quick, you know, Wikipedia search just to see. Oh, yeah, just to see, like, about Lawrence. I was like, oh wow, okay. There's a lot of, there's a lot of pejoratives here. You know, there's, you know, white nationalist accusations and racism accusations and far right and alt right and all these type of things. How do you describe yourself in terms of where things are now? If someone's like, oh, like, where do you fit politically or what are your views?
I don't want to call myself any of the labels because I think after doing this for 10 years and being like online and watching the political conversation for like 15 years, the labels shift so much. I remember being in politics when alt-right meant you were not a neocon. Mm-hmm. That's how different that term has changed over the years. Like,
maybe 8 years ago, nine years ago.
Yeah, it's so. I really like the label that I've seen a few people use, which is I'm just a normal person from like 20 years ago. Mm. Just normal person 20 years ago.
Why do you think that? Like, I have an interesting perspective on the West because I'm British. I'm a British citizen, but my family background is also from Nigeria, and I also grew up in the Middle East, and so I'm like Western in some ways, but in other ways I'm not, like, which becomes very obvious in certain situations where, like, I'll see how people are behaving or attitudes towards a certain thing and I'm just like, that is just so sometimes like totally opposed to, at least in terms of the modern sense right now, like, not so much if you were to go back 20 years ago, you know, I would have been more of a normal person, but now I'm just kind of seeing this cultural suicide rot that all these different countries are doing in their own way. Like, I don't think the greatest threat to any Western nation is a foreign nation. It's this weird self-imposed, like, let's keep hurting ourselves, let's keep stabbing ourselves, let's keep dismantling and demeaning ourselves, and I don't get it.
From a deep sense of self-preservation, it's just that the incentive structure has been flipped upside down by governments. So people are acquiescing to what the tribe wants. They won't be ousted from the tribe and in exile. And, you know, when we talk about women and male differences, women particularly can't be ousted from tribes because they die, especially if they're pregnant or have children and these kind of things. So people very much want to just do what civilization and their general communities want them to pursue so that they won't be socially ostracized. And everyone's like, okay, well, I need to put pronouns in my bio now. I have lawyers that I hire. I have, you know, all sorts of business people that are completely outside of my world that I interact with, whether it be doctors, whatever. And they don't have pronouns in their bio. When they interact with me, half the time they say, oh, I know who you are. Like, do you want me to remove the pronouns from my bio? It's not like a big deal. But like, I'm just doing that for business.
Yeah.
They're just socially adapting to what the incentive structure is around them. And the incentive structure is psychotic because the people running our institutions and our government.
Are these people that you're talking about, do they oppose it and then just acquiesce? Or do they not think it's an issue?
Their passion is whatever they've studied. Mm. They've chosen it, whether it be they want to be a veterinarian. I just want to help them.
Because if
I have to put she, her in my bio, even though I think that's kind of weird, whatever.
I think this entire mentality is the whole problem. So I think it's an issue on both sides, right? I think if you think it's an issue, if you know like this whole pronoun thing or whatever, it's goofy and you can see all the madness that's coming downstream of it and you're like, well, I'm going to do it anyway, then in my opinion, you're a coward. And if you cannot even comprehend why it's an issue, people are pushing you to put he, him in your bio and in your email signature or whatever. And at this point, you know, we're now 9 years into transgender mania and you haven't like connected the dots yet of, oh, actually, this is a whole ideology. It's not just like some minor thing of being polite. Like there's a whole basket of ideas that comes with this. Like if someone hasn't put that together yet, I'm just like, bro, are you stupid? Like, what's wrong?
I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, but I think I understand more than anyone why people do it, why they acquiesce. And that's because I faced the consequences of acquiescing. Like I am banned from countries.
Yeah.
I lost people that are very important to me, best friends of mine that I can never talk to again, family. I have had my life and my reputation completely destroyed to the point where there are certain restaurants I can't go into in day-to-day life. There are, you know, things I have to avoid because I'm scared for my safety all the time. I'll never be able to get a normal job ever in my life. I'm one Google search away from being kicked out of anywhere I go. And, you know, people look at me and they look at the experiences I have. And, well, I would not take back any of it from the world. And I love the life that I have lived authentically very much. I get why people choose to avoid that. I get it.
But there's a middle ground, right? I mean, you go pretty hard. I mean, why are you? It takes a bit to be banned from a country, right? I mean, like what? So you know, let's, you know, both of us like accountability here. So I mean, what did you do to get banned? Well, firstly, what countries are you banned from?
I am banned from the UK for what I mean. Maybe I can go back now. Last time I had a layover through there, I had a bunch of police officers following me around and making sure I wasn't entering the country. Okay. So that was pretty funny. You know, it's a very absurd experience, like just sitting, eating your little hamburger or whatever, and having all these people waiting with their luggage. And then, you know, six police officers show up and surround you. And I'm just thinking, oh my gosh, yeah, make up whatever stories you want. It's fun. But yeah, so the UK, Turkey. I can't go back to Australia. I am banned from, I'm pretty sure, New Zealand as well. Okay. Because they're very tightly linked in their immigration stuff. And then I was banned from the US for a few years.
Okay, why?
I only can get bits and pieces from each country. So Turkey, I was arrested while I was filming Borderless there. And I was facing 5 years in prison for filming in what was considered a military zone. But I also think that that may have been a bit of a cover because Turkey jailed more journalists than North Korea. So they just kind of find a reason and then, you know, threaten you with jail. And that's a whole other podcast to talk about how I got out of that situation. But it was a close call. And I'll never forget the intelligence officer looking at me after they downloaded our phones and taken us into questioning and saying, next time, you don't choose Turkey.
Oh, wow.
Okay. I will not choose Turkey, my son, my friend. Very nice people, though. I like
it. Yeah, Turkey's great.
And then America, it was largely my association with Brittany Pettibone, who was a very, very good friend of mine. And also just my general politics. They questioned me a lot about the documentaries I've made.
But the U.S., I mean, the USA has some crazies in it. Like, I think getting banned from the UK, Australia, I'm like, I kind of get it. To get banned from the US, I'm like, that's pretty tough.
They really did a number to me before COVID. I was kind of forced to leave political activism because I was told I couldn't go to Australia unless I quit speaking out publicly about my thoughts.
Was there a particular issue that you think was causing that, honestly?
I mean, it's definitely the immigration critiques. Definitely, you know, I did a video talking about the Great Replacement, which is this idea. And what's crazy is at the time, I thought it was quite a nuanced video because I just reviewed Renan Camus' theory and I said, is this theory happening or not? Here's what he says. Mm-hmm. Here's the idea. It is this idea that in one time span, one frame, you have a people who live in a country, mm-hmm. and then 10, 20, 30, 50, whatever years, they've been replaced. You have a different population there, a different culture, different language, all these things. And it's the question of, is this happening? So if this can happen in a city, I thought, why can't it happen in a country? And this conversation, in my opinion, doesn't have to happen with any animosity, any hatred towards anyone else. But it's just a realistic conversation of, would Japan still be Japan if you put entirely a Swedish population there?
No.
No.
See, I think this is a really interesting conversation to me. And funnily enough, it's one I even have like with my parents and stuff, because I guess I've got, I have black privilege, right? So I've kind of got this like force field where people look really goofy if they try to call me like a racist or let alone a white supremacist or something. It doesn't mean no one's ever tried, but it doesn't stick very well, right? And so I think when you are part of a minority population, when you've got the melanin force field, you can kind of very openly and frankly talk about immigration or demographic change or whatever. So I think it's kind of interesting because even with this issue, right, like it's called a conspiracy theory, but it's also like acknowledged in the mainstream by super pro immigration, like left wingers and progressives, where they will talk about, you know, hey, the white population of America is declining and, you know, the browning of America. So if someone on the right or a conservative, especially if they're white, like talk about this issue, even in the most like just logical and statistical terms, then they're not even commentating on whether they think this is good or not. Then it's, oh my gosh, this is a Great Replacement conspiracy theory. But then if someone on the left acknowledges it, they're like, yeah, this is happening and this is good and this is fine. So I find it kind of fascinating, that dichotomy. And I'm just like, that is so odd. Like if it's happening, if it's real, if you can like look at numbers and you're seeing this shift happen, whether you think this is good or it's bad or it's neutral, someone might not like the terminology and want to call it something different, but I don't know. What do you make of that?
We're here at the We Unify conference, and I'm going to be giving a speech this morning and talking about how COVID was a somewhat cathartic experience for me, not because it was a good thing and the way the government's treated it was a good thing, but I felt for the first time in my life like everyone around me understood the government that I understood. Because I had been, arrested, questioned, had my rights taken away, had my devices taken by governments and told I wouldn't be allowed to see my family if they didn't get all my passwords to my computers and phones. And the world that I imagined as a kid, where we had these rights and freedoms and we were in a democracy, I thought that was a given. You know, that was the natural state of the Western world. And it wasn't. And it was a lie. And I felt like the government and the media were lying to me about the world that I lived in. And finally, COVID happened. And everyone around me started experiencing the government I understood to exist as this oppressive force that had these powers to abuse us. And it was like this relief of, they understand. People are all privy to what our governments really are deep down. And I think when you talk about this gaslighting going on, you feel insane until it starts to get impossible to deny. So like I talk about how my friends are calling me up now saying, what is going on, Lord?
The hell is it?
The cheating in universities, all of that. It's starting to, the gaslighting, the scales are falling off people's eyes. And unfortunately, yeah, that does happen. It has to happen through experience. People don't learn anything through anything they watch on the internet. Maybe books, they're a little more convincing. But in general, people don't learn anything unless they experience it firsthand. Until it starts hurting their wallet, they're just not going to care. So this is why I'm kind of a little more realistic when I talk about, okay, so all these people I know and I actually like and think are pretty cool are putting pronouns in their bio. And I just have to accept that. That's just how humans are. You're not going to be able to interact with them.
Man, if one of my good friends did that, I'd be on the phone immediately. I'd be like, bro, what the heck are you doing?
Bro, I do that. And they're like, well, let's talk about this. And I understand how humans are. And I've just accepted, like, okay, you're going to have to experience it. And my hope is that what happened during COVID, the lockdown, the complete violation of our rights, especially in places like Canada that occurred, is the wake-up call that we needed. I hope this is going... I mean, you're seeing these like right-wing parties like Marine Le Pen making massive strides in Europe, right? And Pierre Poilievre, I think he's going to win this upcoming election here in Canada. I do think it has been a wake-up call for people where they're like, oh, wow. I think the natural state of government and human history and how we conducted ourselves in nation-building is oppressive regimes. I think all of these, especially... when an economy collapses, you either go economy or you go fash, right? So our economy is in trouble. Our culture is in trouble. Our infrastructure, our values, morals as a nation are in crisis right now. And that's where people turn to extreme solutions. That's when governments feel they can start to bring in emergency powers to fix things as crime gets higher and all these things. So COVID was this test run of how far they can go with violating our rights. And I worry that the next time they decide to go that far, the next time they bring in emergency acts, we will have even less stability as a country. There will be less gun rights, less, economic prosperity, less integration in communities. And the government is never going to let go of that power again. They take it. And so I feel COVID may be a last chance. We were actually very blessed that it was just this four years of oppression that we experienced that may still give us a chance to swerve away from that.
Yeah.
A little wake-up call of what our governments actually are and what humans are capable of and how we really can treat each other. Snitching out our neighbors, turning people in, wishing the worst on one another, our family members. That's how humans are. We're under a thin veneer of civility.
Yeah.
That is so easily lost.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I don't know your personal religious beliefs or attitudes towards faith, but in my opinion, all of these things that are happening in all these Western nations, particularly in the Anglo ones, to me, it's the inevitable consequences of becoming increasingly godless societies. I think I had a tweet go super viral on X, and even Elon agreed with it. And I was basically saying, I've been thinking about this a lot. I can't remember the exact wording, but it was like, if the West loses Christianity, it's screwed. It's like hacking away at the roots of a tree and pulling the, we don't need these roots. Let's just knock this down. Let's knock all these foundations down. And then it starts to wobble and break down in all sorts of ways, which might not immediately seem connected because they're not first order effects. But it's just like the root has been attacked so much and people have become so comfortable and complacent and prideful. I mean, the fact that there's a whole month, hey, let's celebrate a great sin for a whole month. Like the fact that that's even considered normal, and me even saying that it's kind of weird that there's a whole month celebrating sin. And then like even if I said that, oh, you're being a bigot, you're being a homophobe, whatever. I'm just like, this is just a sign of the insanity because I don't believe you can have a vacuum. There's always going to be a religion / ideology, and people are substituting the Christian faith with wokeness and with LGBTQAIPT2. I don't even know how long it is now. And they're just fulfilling it with all these other ideologies, and the state is becoming God at the same time. It's idol worship.
I'm a Christian, but I like to always caveat with I am a struggling Christian, like searching. I'm always at war with God. And I know that might sound bad, but it's a constant back and forth of me walking away because I'm a human and making mistakes and falling into sin, and then coming back and realizing like I need this. Yes. I need this structure in my life and this goodness and this pursuit of the good for humanity. And so it's struggle always. And my pastor actually did a recent, at the beginning of Pride Month, I thought it was a beautiful sermon. He was just talking about how pride comes before the fall, and he doesn't understand why that would be what you would wave your banner. I also think it's ironic that, the pride flag is the rainbow.
Yeah, it's intentional.
I'm never going to flood the earth again.
I mean, in the past year, obviously I've been to the UK, when I was in the Netherlands, when I was in Ireland, just all of these Western nations, I'm just like, you have just adopted this. I mean, did you see in the UK, they took down on like Oxford Street and Regent Street, these massive, massive roads in central London. they took down the British flags and replaced every single one with a pride flag. And I'm just like, the symbolism of this, like some people are like, oh, why do you care? Whatever. Are you homophobe? I'm like, guys, do you not see the significance of you're taking a national flag, which represents the entire country, over 65 million people, and you are replacing it with a sign to, quote unquote, celebrate homosexuality, which at tops is like 2-3% of the population. And of that demographic, a lot of them don't even want you to be doing that. Like, they don't even feel represented by this because they're not these far left activists. They're just, you know, relative, you know, they're just normal people who happen to have a certain sexual preference. And you're like that replacement. I'm just like, this is, I don't even think y'all see what you're doing here. And I think people are so afraid to say anything about it. I'll say something about it, but most people won't. And it just continues.
You know, I actually think, I just want to touch on my pastor's sermon a bit more because I think he ended it beautifully, but he's like, actually, there is a lot to celebrate here. There is a lot to celebrate for these people that are putting up the pride flags and doing the march and everything. And it's quite debasing to believe that you need to have pride in just your sexuality. Debasing to believe that that's what defines you. It is the most important aspect of you. Like, every human being has divinity in them. Goodness. Like, the fact that we are alive, the fact that we are here, like, it is proof of God. It's proof of something greater and beautiful. And that divinity, just who they are as a soul. All these people who are left-wing progressives, they show up. There is a soul in there, and there's goodness in there, and there's a spark of God in there that deserves to be celebrated. And I couldn't think of anything more sick and cruel and twisted than to believe that the most important thing about these people is some silly sexual identity that half of them will change in 2-3 years. Like, to base your reality around that is so... It's such a stifling of the soul within these people that I think is what's happening on a mass level. People's souls are being stifled, who they actually are, living authentically. All of that has been so stifled, and the only way you're allowed to have any identity is in the confines of these strange fetishisms that are occurring across the West. And I actually think that's why people are so drawn to it.
Amen.
They want meaning, they want understanding, they want to pursue something more, but the only way they're able to do that, it's like the government has taken away all our freedoms in every other realm of self-exploration and thought and self-expression, while they've expanded all of our freedoms in sexuality and drug use and these kind of things. So people who truly want to understand more are just going to the freedom that has been advertised to them. And I think it's actually confined them into boxes or suppressing their true, what would truly make them happy. I mean, there's a reason these people are all on SSRIs.
Yes.
There's a reason these people are depressed, and they are beautiful people that deserve good, beautiful lives, and they have been stifled by a system made to hold them in and tell them that they can only express freedom and find truth and knowledge in these ridiculous sexual fetishisms.
Wow. Your pastor is on point, and that analysis is on point. It brought up a thought which is really interesting to me. So, you know, I lived in Saudi Arabia for 20 years, and I now live in the UAE. So, you know, I've spent a lot of my time living in the Middle East, and I currently live in a, you know, Islamic country, technically. And it's interesting because if I'm talking to someone from the West who has never been to the Middle East at all and doesn't know much about it, if I talk about Dubai or the UAE or in Saudi or something like that, and there's questions around freedom and liberty and so on, it's almost always the same two questions. And I think the fact that that's immediately where people's brains go, by the way, whether they're conservative or liberal, I find quite fascinating. It's always, how tolerant are they of drugs? And how tolerant are they of homosexuality? And it's like that is the default barometer for freedom in people's brains now. So regardless of what someone may think or what, you know, the answer may be or something, I think it's interesting that that is like what people consider being free, right? It's basically, can I smoke weed? And, you know, are they cool about people having, you know, gay sex? And I'm like, that's like, there's a lot of aspects of freedom and, as you said, human dignity and individuality and so on that are... not that. And so, I don't even know exactly what it means. I just think it reveals something.
Also, a bit of conservatism being used against itself. You were talking about, like, in the 90s, where you had people that were like, we need to ban Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. we need to, like, I think that the focus on stuff like weed and, you know, homosexuality actually has been the wrong focus, and it's given power to the left and progressives in order to weaponize this as this is the vision of freedom. Because in reality, like, I love all people. My friends that are straight are partaking in just as much sin and falling short of what they should be achieving as my friends who are gay or all different. And it's like, but there's this like particular focus on homosexuality or weed smoking instead of one's own vices. Like, the amount of people that will constantly rag on homosexuality that are the most prideful, egotistical, selfish people I've ever met, as if any of those things aren't sins, is astonishing, right? So I think when there is a particular focus and highlighting of, nope, these are the only bad things to do, instead of culturally just looking at, okay, instead of banning these things, instead of constantly demonizing these things, how can we talk about healing people and making the world better and making people want the good rather than banning them from the bad? Because that's not how you stop anything. Mm-hmm. You don't stop people doing drugs by putting, banning drugs. We know that. The war on drugs.
Well, it does work in many countries. I think what doesn't work is the halfway measure. I think that's one where either you go towards like Portugal style.
Like, I've been in the Arctic Circle where they have these small towns where they've got like 3 hours of sunlight and they've had to ban alcohol because everyone's alcoholic and like petrol. Yeah. You know, it's, they find substitutes. People find substitutes for vices. So what you want to do is you want to create people that want to avoid vices because they live in a world that has community. They have people that love them. They have, you know, there's G.K. Chesterton wrote about drinking, saying, drinking is a good thing. It's a beautiful thing. You know, Jesus made wine, right? But you should always drink to enhance a love or a joy or experience. You should never drink to suppress it, suppress a sadness or a feeling. And I think the reason we see this uptick in drug use, certainly here in Vancouver, this uptick in, you know, pursuing of the vices, is that there is an emptiness and a void people are trying to fill rather than the pursuit of enhancing an experience of joy or something. And so I think we shouldn't be looking at banning the vices because people will just fill it with another one. We should be looking to create community, stability, and joy in people's lives so that they don't want to choose those things.
I have mixed feelings on that. I think that the thing is, I totally get what you're saying. And I think, again, it comes back to what I was talking about before, where there's a lot of, the West is full of Christian residue, right? Very, very culturally Christian in many ways, and from the laws to the moral attitudes to the general ethics and things. And of course, there are still lots of Christian people, you know, practicing Christians in our various countries. But I think that the problem is with the total secularization of the attitudes and the laws and the social standards and anything, what we've inevitably ended up with is this weird society and culture where it's just like, it's libertinism. It's like, well, if it doesn't directly impact you or harm you, you shouldn't care about anything. And in fact, even if you care, even if you disapprove, you're being judgmental. And in a country with only consent-based morality, there's no greater sin than being judgmental, right? So it's just supposed to be like, okay, whatever, dude, like, you do whatever you want. And so I'm not here like advocating, you know, the state come in and do this and this and this and this, right? But the problem is, I think freedom and liberalism in the proper sense, they work when you, I mean, the American founders knew this, right? It works when you have a moral population, right? When there are other laws and social codes and everything like that to keep people bound in and in check, faith, family, standards, judgments, and so on. Go ahead.
Judgment around COVID. That was a lot of judgment and social standards.
Yeah, but it was misdirected. It was misdirected because people adopted COVID as a religion, not their actual religion.
Religion matters, and not just the facade of religion. I find that there's a lot of people that, you know, they'll go around and they'll like to use the Bible for demonizing everyone else except themselves. You know, this is what so much of the Bible is about. The Pharisees,
yep.
People who cared so much about image, rules, and laws, and really just wanted to distract from their own lack of connection with goodness or God or anything, and did so by enforcing all of these rules and laws. So if there isn't that kind of Christ-like aspect of the culture that's enforcing these rules, where you are genuinely doing it because you have a deep love for other people, you want their good, and when you tell them and when you judge them, I mean, only God can judge, really, but when you tell them, you know, I think that this is bad for you and you should stop it, you are doing that because you think it's bad for them, not because you get a little devious schadenfreude, a kick from the idea of someone else being lesser than you. And that's where I think the problem comes in. That was the idea with COVID. That's the idea with some aspects of how people enforce, I think, a facade version of religion in some cases, where it is being done out of one's own pride, ego, and schadenfreude, that enforcement. Once again, with COVID, you need to put on the mask. You're lesser than me. You're a disease spreader. You're this, you're that. Unless it is coming from a place of true love, mm-hmm. fellow citizen, any judgment.
But I feel like even when it is, it's still considered hate. Well, that's the problem, right? So it's still, look at the protesters out there yesterday. Yeah, I know that does exist, and it always has existed, right? There is a pocket of people. It doesn't matter the religion, right? It could even be no religion, right? There are just some people. I mean, we would say that the far left super wokies, like, they're the most aggressive and, you know, bigoted people in many ways, right? But they have the veneer of, oh, I'm going to put up my social justice is my shield. And I agree. Of course, there are people who, whether it's Christianity, Islam, Judaism, whatever, they use their religion or their ideology to hide behind as a barrier for them just not being a good person.
Everyone's just signaling goodness. And that's what's so scary, is it's being so abused. And you have to be, that's kind of why I'm talking about it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, ooh, when we talk about creating cultural structures based on judgment, we better be sure it's not just signaling goodness, because throughout human history, all of the biggest abuses have happened because it's for the greater good. Mm-hmm. We're doing this for the greater good. We're doing this for God. We're doing this for whatever. That's actually, you know, when they talk about using God's name in vain, I love this. I can't remember who did the analysis, but it's like everyone thinks, God damn it, when they think of using God's name in vain. But I think the more, you know, intense using of his name in vain is to say, God is telling me that you have to do this, but you're actually saying this from your own perspective of, I want you to do this. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say I'm getting some sort of direct message from God telling you to do it. And then that's really using his name in vain.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, where do we, it's a question I even want to ask here. I mean, this is such a fascinating discussion, because I feel like increasingly, like, I've always been a Christian, and I've never, like, you know, totally strayed from the faith or anything. It's weird because I love the West, but I think it's even telling in the fact that, like, I left the UK in 2021 and I was actually going to move to the USA. I was, you know, I've been traveling lots of different countries, over 20 different countries over the last couple of years. And I was thinking, okay, I've put myself in a position where I can pretty much live in whatever city or country I want to. I look around the map, I'm traveling to all these places, like, where do I want to live and where would I want to potentially raise my future family? I was like, sadly, not the UK, it doesn't make me happy to say that. Right. It doesn't. I'm not saying that, like, yeah, I want to dunk on the UK. And it's like, no, that's, you know, I'm a British citizen. But for various reasons, I'm like, all right, this is not the place for me. And then the US was, you know, I was going to move to the US, and I could live in many parts of the US. But I was just looking at, I'm just looking at the society and the culture and all the stuff and where it's going. And even just the attitude towards family, the attitudes towards kids, the attitudes towards all these things. And I'm just like, this is so, it's so perverse and godless on such a scale where I'm just like, you know, if 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it would be easy decision to make. Cool, I'm leaving the UK, I'm going to move to the USA. And I ended up moving back to the Middle East. I ended up moving to Dubai when I'm there, I'm like, yeah, like, this is not even a Christian country, but in many ways, in terms of, like, the virtues and the attitudes and the morality and the social codes, it feels more like one, which is a really weird thing to say. And that, it's kind of like, it is what it is, but it also kind of, I feel a sense of deep sadness with that, because it's about the trajectory of where these countries are going. Like the UK is on a certain trajectory, and I don't see what pulls it up out of that nosedive. In the US, I think there's more hope because it's so big and there's like all these pockets.
For Canada to be saved, what would that look like? What does that mean?
Well, I think we'd need to immediately stop the immigration that we have now, like just complete and total shutdown until we can figure out what the hell is going on. You'd have to send a lot of people back that are on these BS visas at the moment. We would have to get a lot of foreign money out of being intertwined with Canadian property and business. China owns, I think it's like 60% of the properties in areas like Richmond are owned by overseas buyers. They call it gray zone warfare in kind of the intelligence military community, where it's basically you do everything you possibly can right up to the point of kinetic warfare. And the West has no understanding of this. Like, we are walking around like, oh, we're doing great, this and that. And they're at war with us.
Yep.
Like, they're in an active war, and we are delusional. Hey, welcome to our country. See, they're on a 100-year plan. They're like, we have a goal we're trying to get to. We can't even figure out what we want to do tomorrow. And they're like, all right, well, apparently these people in the West are literally just going to let us buy all of their businesses and property. So why would we send troops on the ground when we can just do that?
And own Hollywood and brainwash all the kids with TikTok and own the NBA.
All their social media companies will literally own their brains. We've got Sydney Harbor on hinges right now, and we can flip it into Shanghai in like a second if we want to. Like, why would they ever have a land war when they can just buy our entire countries and political parties? If you ever saw the, I don't know if you followed the Trudeau liberal like Chinese scandal that went on, but heavily influencing our elections here. We're talking honeypot Chinese girls coming up and cozying up to our politicians, payment plans. They've got, if half the scam calls you get in this country are all in Chinese, I don't know if they're like, hey guys, we're mobilizing now. Like, I don't know what you're saying. It's Chinese. But half the political advertisements around our towns are in Chinese as well. They will never have to step a foot. They will never have to fire a single bullet and we'll be conquered because we're just out to lunch.
This is what I mean. It's so weird to me because this is all these attitudes combined are the things I find so odd, like this despondency and this sort of just lack of care. It's almost like so many Western nations and so many Western peoples are kind of just in this like shoulder shrug, just kind of like, eh. Because the thing is, even when we talk about, like, I know and I'm aware of more of things that China is doing in various nations and continents, right? They're in Africa, they're in Australasia, they're in North America, right? I'm talking about, like, the Chinese government, right? They're doing all sorts of things to have gain influence and gain power and gain financial resources and so on. And I'm kind of like, I'm not mad at China for that. I'm like, well, yeah, of course they're doing that. Like, you see what I mean? I'm just like, duh. I mean, look what the UK did with the British Empire. Look at like all the other empires that have gone on. So I'm just like, this is the 21st century version of it. Like, if your enemies are asleep, you know what I mean? And you don't even need to. It's just like, why wouldn't I? Like, if I'm a rich Chinese businessman or I'm some, right? Like, yeah, oh, I can buy up this whole building.
This is actually the aspect of the conversation that's been missing, and something that when I was younger I didn't reiterate enough. None of these conversations of understanding how the world works and humans work and immigration and, you know, invasion has to do with hating anyone. Do I hate Chinese people for buying property in Richmond? No, I don't have to. In fact, that's what Canadians would be doing if we had the laws and policies the other way around. Mm-hmm. It's human. Do I hate migrants for abusing the refugee system and coming into Europe? No, I don't hate them. In fact, in a lot of ways, that's the only way to, like, the refugee system is so broken,
yes,
so abused, and the legal migrant system is so abused that you're going to get screwed over if you try to do things the legal way. Like, we have reversed the incentive structures in everything, and everyone is just acting in almost the most human way possible. But our job as people who care about our communities and countries, our government's job, media's job, their jobs are supposed to be to talk about this logically. How do humans actually function? What is this going to result as? How do we make policies that constrain the natural, you know, choices of humans that in often cases are self-interested in a way that is better for overall civilization? And no one is doing that. And that's why it's fallen apart. Nothing actually has to be malicious.
Yeah. You know what? I'll tell you something which you probably don't hear very often. Years ago, I think I've known who you are maybe for like 7 or 8 years. And I've watched your Farmlands documentary. I watched, is it Borderless, the one you did on migration? And I never got any idea about all the slurs on Wikipedia or whatever. I actually watched those and I thought you were compassionate and understanding. I didn't watch those and think like, oh, this is some like, you know, hateful person who just hates him, you know, the very lazy way people like to interpret some of these things, right? It's just like, these are incentive structures and loopholes that exist. And so, yeah, people are going to take advantage of it. If you are living in some poor part of Central America or South America, or you can come over on a boat from North Africa or whatever to have a better life for you and your family and economic opportunities, unless someone's really dense, it's not hard to understand why somebody would do that.
Well, these slurs racist and whatnot, they never mean anything. They're used to control a conversation 99% of the time. Like, you know, of course, every once in a while, you're going to get one where it's like, okay, this is actually an applicable use. But most of the time, these words are used to shut up critics of systems that are corrupt. So like white people called me racist for calling it, you know, Indian food at Tim Hortons. Well, look at the amount of money that big corporations are making from this structure that we have going on right now with mass cheap labor importation. Look at the amount of money politicians and investment firms are making in housing bubble, just increasing and increasing and increasing at the, of course, the people that are corrupt the most are the lower middle class, but they don't have as much power. You know, the amount of money being made in government, all of it. Racist is just such a great term to use to shut up anyone who is, quite frankly, criticizing a racially abusive exploitation system, ironically enough. Yeah. And they've just decided, well, everything people fought for in human history that was like civil rights and whatnot, they were fighting against racists. So what if we just call them racists when they're fighting against civil rights and fighting for freedom now?
Do you think it's how much of it do you think is white guilt?
A lot of cases, it's people that are so desperate to be seen as good that they're willing to ignore any of the risk taking that actually being good comes with. Because actually being good doesn't mean being praised by every institution. It doesn't mean being told, oh, you're such a wonderful, like, you don't get that by actually being good. You get ostracized and kicked out of institutions. Power, money, government, these things are corrupt. When you criticize them, you suffer. No one is suffering from partaking in white guilt flagellation. They are getting jobs. They are getting made the head of, you know, departments. They are getting appointed, you know, awards and art shows and these kind of things. So this performative self-flagellation of white guilt is actually a very selfish act, in my opinion. And willing to destroy an entire civilization to be perceived as good.
Yeah, it's the virtue signaling versus actual virtue.
Maybe there are some that truly feel guilt, but I think they snap out of that real quickly the first time they get called mayo skin hockey and actually go into that first neighborhood and learn that everyone's a little racist.
I think if more people traveled, then in many, many, many ways, the world would just be a better place, because so many people lack perspective and they lack gratitude and they lack points of comparison. So, like, I find with a lot of lefties, they tend to compare things to utopia, right? So if they say, I don't know, Canada's a racist country, or America's a racist country, UK's a racist country, I'm always like, compared to what, right? Historically and geographically, compared to what, right? Because if you're talking about history and you're talking about the world, by any measure, these are some of the least racist countries in the world, okay? But they have no reference point. So they're comparing to a perfect utopia, which I call unicornia, which doesn't exist, where there is zero any type of bigotry and bias. And I'm just like, that place does not exist. And same with like so many of the policies and ideas and things like they have, it's not grounded in reality. It's all like, oh, well, in a perfect world, you could have open borders and, you know, and we can defund the police because like no one would commit crime, and let's just send out social workers when someone's getting robbed. Like, they have all these like really goofy ideas detached from reality. And I think when people have like traveled to other countries, other nations, other continents. You've seen how people live in different places and just like the human condition and how things are. You very quickly just get a more, I don't even want to say conservative, just like a realistic, like reality is more conservative. Lauren, I'm very conscious of the time. We could talk forever. But what have you got lined up for the future? What is next for Lauren Southern?
I'm always looking at where things are going politically next. You know, I think we get bogged down in a lot of these cycles. 2016, Gamergate, feminists. And then it was just so much content around that. And then now we're kind of back into the cycle of gender war topic. And I think it's so important to escape the cycles of how you're maximizing views, maximizing money, and actually finding new frontiers that's going to start real conversations that people are unwilling to have. So right now I'm on the hunt for the new frontier of conversation that we need to be having that people aren't willing to touch. I think that's always been my expertise, is starting conversations that get me in a lot of trouble and get me banned for places, and then open up, hopefully, on everyone else to come after the berserkers have gone in and taken a lot of the damage. So I'm looking for that next conversation.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate your sacrifice, and I hope you can come back to my home country one day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.